There are lots of reasons why you would not want to have been a surgical patient in the early 19th century. Anesthesia had not been introduced. If you were lucky, a glass of wine might dull your senses. A crowd might watch from the operating theater. Scrubbing in for surgery was unheard of, and the best you could hope for was a surgeon who was quick enough to lessen your pain, methodical enough to do the job right. And immediately after, you'd have been sent home in a dirty carriage bouncing on cobblestone streets. When the young Dr. Thomas Dent Mutter burst onto the scene in silk cravats and stylish suits, medicine was ripe for change. Learn how a penniless orphan from Virginia revolutionized medicine in his time and pioneered the field of plastic surgery. That's coming up on Midday after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. Philadelphia in the early 1800s was an easy place to die, writes our guest this hour, author and poet Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz. You could just as easily die of a broken bone as an asthma attack or even a rotten tooth. You could perish from contaminated food and drink or fall victim to one of the many infectious diseases that ran rampant through the crowded urban area. Smallpox, yellow fever, cholera. The doctor's treatment, bloodletting, leeching, and purgatives, could just as easily kill you as cure you. Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz takes us back to the 1830s and the dawn of what we know as modern surgery as she writes about the fascinating life and accomplishments of Dr. Thomas Dent Mutter. Or Mutter. We'll get to the pronunciation during this hour of the show. We'll also hear about the shocking world of primitive medicine in the early to mid-19th century. Kristen also gives ample page time in her new book to Dr. Mutter's contemporaries, including those who held vastly opposing views on the best way to treat patients. Dr. Mutter is the subject of Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz's book, Dr. Mutter's Marvels, A True Tale of Intrigue and Innovation at the Dawn of Modern Medicine. It's published by Gotham Books, an imprint of the Penguin Group. And Kristen, first of all, welcome to Midday. Nice to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
I've got your name pronounced correctly, Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz. But now, as far as Mutter, a lot of folks know the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia, and that's who we're talking about, the
yes.
doctor that for which that museum is named. M-U-T-T-E-R. When he was born.
Yes, Mutter. Tom Mutter of Virginia when
right,
he was born.
Right. And then Tom Mutter added the umlaut over the U, right?
Yes, absolutely.
But he wasn't German. He was American, born in Virginia.
Yes.
But he surgically attached the umlaut to his name.
Yes.
At what point in his life?
Right after he studied surgery in Paris.
Oh, well, that explains
and
it, doesn't
he,
it?
He was introduced to a new field of surgery called l'opérations plastique, or plastic surgery as we now know it today. Perhaps what we would call his work would be reconstructive surgery, because he specialized on plastic surgery on the severely deformed in a time before anesthesia. And he knew that this was going to be the thing that would make his name in America. He was young, ambitious, beautiful, and he thought the one thing that maybe he needed to, you know, very American thought to push him into celebrity is maybe adding a little flair to his name. So he went from
right.
Tom Mutter of Virginia to Dr. Thomas Dent Mutter.
Mutter.
Or Paris learned surgeon.
So do you pronounce it Mutter, like shooter? And I was saying earlier Mutter.
Right.
Because I called the museum and listened to their recording in Philadelphia, and the person who did the recording said Mutter.
The museum itself disagrees on how to pronounce his name. So really any version is probably right. We don't know until that time machine happens. We're just going to take a guess. But I, from my educated stance, I believe that you don't add an umlaut if you're Mutter and not change the pronunciation.
All right. Well, so today we'll go with Mutter?
Yes.
Or Mutter. All right. Either one is fine.
Either one is
Dr. fine. Dr. Tommy was born in Virginia. A lot of people know this museum. This is a famous museum in Philadelphia.
Yes.
I would say famous because people know it.
Right. Infamous.
You might
perhaps.
Even say infamous. So if you've been there and have a question about it or comment about it, you can call us during this hour as we share it with Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz with her new book, Dr. Mutter's Marvels, A True Tale of Intrigue and Innovation at the Dawn of Modern Medicine. So you grew up in Philadelphia, and I wonder, if you remember the first time you visited that museum.
Absolutely. For my generation, visiting the Mütter Museum was sort of a rite of passage with the school kids. You would hear about it for years, right? First and second graders would hear, oh, you're going to go to this museum, and they've got limbs in jars and ladies with horns growing from their heads. And, you know, you would, all the girls would say, oh, I'm going to get there. I'm going to faint. I'm going to pass out. I'll be so terrified. And you'd finally be brought there. I was brought there by nuns, Catholic school nuns in the fourth grade. And I remember my first experience is just, you know, being in shock that it was exactly as advertised to me by my older siblings, who are usually terrible liars. but also, you know, it did something for me that had never happened to me in a learning context. You know, I always say that if a woman with a horn growing from her head walked into a supermarket, your mother would say, you're allowed to look anywhere you want, except at this woman with the horn in her head, all right? I want you to look anywhere but at her.
Right.
And this museum said, no, come closer. I want you to look at these things you've been told your whole life never to stare at, and stare at it and look at it and ask questions and ask, why did this happen? Does this still happen? How do we treat it today? How did we treat it back then? What causes it? And that sort of curiosity-driven learning in science was something that I had never experienced before.
Before you went to the museum.
Before I went to the museum, science was sort of, how does evolution work? What is the heart? You know, it kind of has answers you already knew. And this museum was filled with all sorts of unusual stuff that people were struggling to understand and struggling to fix in the 19th century. And I really tried to use that technique in Dr. Mütter's Marvels. You know, the book has 80 illustrations, and I wanted people to be sort of drawn in and go, whoa, 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 what is going on in this picture, as a way to understand better how medicine evolved.
Because he had a particular interest in treating people who had, deformities?
Severe,
people who had been, damaged in fires, all kinds of different ways that they had been scarred for life. But he wanted to treat them, right?
Absolutely. And you have to sort of, again, put yourself in the mindset of 19th century medicine. Surgery was being performed while the patients were still awake, right? So you actually had men who were literally hired to hold the patient down onto the table during the surgery, you know, to keep them still, but also to prevent them from jumping up and running away. That's what I would do when someone stuck a knife into my stomach.
Right.
So the idea of performing surgery on patients in an elective sense, you know, these people, it wasn't life or death for them whether or not they had these surgeries. It was a surgery they were volunteering to do to help give a better life for them. And so few people during that time period, surgeons, would even risk to do that, you know, because infection rates were killing an enormous percentage of people, and they didn't understand why. Germ theory wouldn't be proven until the late 1800s with the invention of the modern microscope. So surgeries are incredibly risky, and unless the patient was going to die anyway, you wouldn't do it. Mütter, however, was extremely skilled, a brilliant operating hand. He was ambidextrous, equally talented in both hands, and fastidiously clean in a time when that was not normal in 19th century medicine. And one of my favorite phrases I learned in my research was, the stiffer the frock with blood, the prouder the busy surgeon, which meant you were expected
to carry the viscera of
your patients to prove that you were trustworthy.
Wow.
So that's how different it was back then. So Mütter loved working with this population because they were ignored by medicine, and he could be their savior.
Well, how did he get his start? We know he was born in Virginia, and it sounds like he was born to a family that was fairly well off. He could have been a child of fortune, but it didn't work out that way, did it?
That's right. Back, you know, we were talking about germ theory not being proven. They didn't quite understand how diseases spread back then. So you would have things like yellow fever or cholera enter a town and devastate entire families, entire neighborhoods even. And Mütter's family was one that really suffered. His entire family, mother, father, grandmother, and brother, all died in quick succession, and everyone was dead by the time he was 8. He himself survived, but was very ill throughout his childhood. He was eventually adopted by Colonel Robert Carter, with, if you remember from your 7th grade history class, of the famous King Carter family. And he was sort of a, you know, an erratic supporter of the boy. You know, he kept food in his belly and a roof over his head, but he didn't really guide the kid or have any interest in him. But Mütter knew from a young age that he wanted to be great. And
At something, right?
At first, he was just looking the part. He famously ran up enormous clothing bills, charging them to the school, and then earning scholarships to offset the cost of his clothing bills.
Wait did he go to school?
He went to boarding schools throughout his childhood and then eventually to Hampton Sydney College in Virginia for his undergraduate degree. And by that time, his clothing style was so outrageous, the theater company used his clothing as their theatrical costumes. So that gives you an idea of how flamboyant he was.
Was he a fop?
He was known as a dandy. He was a dandy. A bit of a dandy.
All right, let me ask you this. So you're saying you established that he was pretty much an orphan by 7 or 8 years old, right? So it was Carter who funded him going off to school?
Yes.
Okay. So he managed to do that. Yes. And then how did his interest in medicine develop?
He went to Yale for a winter. You know, he wanted to be great. Knew Yale was a great school. Went there and had never experienced a northern winter. Got so sick, began just coughing up blood. And the school finally sent him home. And he made a stop at Atlanta. His paternal grandfather had been a doctor. And his paternal grandfather's friends agreed to meet with him. And these were the first doctors that ever treated him with respect. You know, that didn't see themselves as infallible gods. I will cure you by putting 100 leeches on your stomach and you will be cured of all your ills. Instead, these were gentlemen saying, hey, this is what I'm seeing. This is what the outcome is going to be. This is how you're going to treat yourself. And you're never going to get, you know, as healthy as this. But if you behave in these certain ways, you can at least get to this stage. And it was revolutionary for him. And in that moment, he knew, this is what I want to be. I want to be that kind of doctor.
He met doctors in his own family who had some bedside manner.
Yes, who treated patients as human beings and not as problems that they were destined to solve. Hmm. And so he wrote his guardian and said, I have an idea. I want to go to medical school and become a doctor. And Colonel Robert Carter supported him going to University of Pennsylvania, the first ever medical school in the United States, founded by Boston's own Ben Franklin. And that's when he got a medical degree. He was brilliant, got his medical degree at the age of 21. And shortly after that, realized that surgery was going to have to be his specialty because he came from poorer circumstances. And back then, if you were going to be a family doctor of a wealthy family, you had to be wealthy yourself. This is personal, private business, medical health. You're going to be seeing people naked, which was not done in modest 19th century America. So they only trusted people from the same caste system. But again, in a time before anesthesia, when you were going to be awake when someone amputates your leg, at that point, you kind of don't care if that guy's played tennis with your dad. All you care about is, will this surgery happen quickly with the least amount of pain as possible, and will I survive the surgery? And so he knew skill could rise him up the ranks, and so he chose that field.
Skill and speed.
Yes, very
right?
much
this
so.
This became sort of his operating, his modus operandi, right? Get them, work on them quickly and correctly.
And cleanly, absolutely, and treat and have them be partners in the surgery. That was what made him unique. Back then, they used to say, you know, you would ask, today, will you have your gangrenous leg off? And they would say, no, no, no. And then the moment the patient says, yes, today I will have my leg off, that is the last decision that patient is allowed to make. You are allowed to ignore everything they say from that point on. You're the surgeon. Mutter, however, once he knew surgery was going to happen, would walk the patient through the surgery, answer questions, show them the tools, and in some cases, do a lot of preoperative care to prepare the body for what was going to happen. Never done before in surgery. And that's because I believe he was a patient throughout his entire childhood and knew how he wished he had been treated. So he treated his patients the same way. And that is why he developed the amount of trust necessary to build up the reputation that he had and to receive the clientele. I mean, he worked with people who were medically categorized as monsters. That was a medical categorization back then, just like idiot was a medical term back then.
You mean
then.
If you had some deformity, if you had been scarred by an accident of some kind?
Right. Birth defect or by accident. The labor laws did not really protect human beings back then very well. Mm-hmm. So you have these dramatic factory accidents, and you would be so deformed that they would just categorize you as a monster, and that would be the end of you. You got no more treatment.
I don't want to skip over this, the importance of the University of Pennsylvania there and a medical school.
Yes.
This idea. So the U.S. was pretty much a backwater in terms of medicine at that time, right? Compared to, say, Europe.
Compared to Europe, absolutely.
Certainly compared to Europe. So how did all that get started? I mean, who were those people that pushed to have better medical education and to try to advance the procedures?
It was a long process, I'll be honest with you. You know, you had apprenticeships. That's basically how doctors were taught, as with many of the fields back then. To start a medical school was an unusual idea. But even with the popularity of medical schools, even as more medical schools grew, you did not need a degree to practice medicine, nor a license. I mean, back then you could literally just put a shingle out, say you're a doctor, and stick leeches on people and call it a day. So first you needed to create these medical schools, create a need for them, and create doctors that would sort of spread the gospel of these schools. And it took decades for a tipping point to happen where you would now say, well, now we need people to go to these schools.
Yeah.
And that didn't even happen in Mutter's lifetime.
We'll take a break here. This is great. Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz, her book is called Dr. Mutter's Marvels, A True Tale of Intrigue and Innovation at the Dawn of Modern Medicine. A short break here on Midday. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Dan Roderick's here on Midday, speaking with Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz about her book, Dr. Mutter's Marvels. Dr. Mutter's Marvels, A True Tale of Intrigue and Innovation at the Dawn of Modern Medicine. You may have visited the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia. This is the doctor for which that's named. And his collection, entire collection, is there, right?
That's right.
Including the world's largest colon. am I correct? I saw a photograph of that once.
Yeah, the 9-foot megacolon, which was extracted from a human, only known as the human balloon, is on display. And it is such a popular part of the Mutter Museum that they have created a plushy version of it for their gift store. So if you love that megacolon so much, you can take it home with you now.
I visit this place. I'm sorry, I have not visited it. But actually, visiting that museum as a kid, and later you did you wrote a screenplay for a movie about Dr. Mutter.
Absolutely, yeah. Right? I was, I grew up working class, so I was paying my own way through college. NYU, not the smartest choice if you are paying your way through college. Always on the lookout for scholarships to help offset the costs. And the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, which people probably know if you watch PBS, the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, it supports artists who want to bring science into the mainstream and into greater audiences. And they created a fellowship for the best screenplay or play based on the life of a scientist or scientific discovery. It was the first year they were doing it. I was like, the pool is going to be very small. I'm a nerd. I'll do it. I just need to think of a science story that maybe no one has ever told before. And that's when I thought of the Mutter Museum. Growing up in Philadelphia, it's just a part of your childhood.
Right.
But when you leave Philly, you realize not everyone has a medical oddity science museum in their childhood. And people would ask, what's the deal with that museum? And I realized for as many times as I've been there, I had no idea if Mutter was a man, a family, an acronym.
Just a collector.
Right.
Not really a doctor.
Yeah, absolutely.
But he really was a doctor.
He was. The first time I went to the archive, all I thought was like, please don't be a racist, which you never know in 19th century.
Right.
But he turned out to be this brilliant innovator, this plastic surgeon who was specializing on helping a population of society that medicine had largely ignored. And these odd things that he collected, these pathological specimens, were teaching tools and challenges to himself. You know, because he was getting the most unusual cases of deformities and disfigurements from all across the country, he had to look at some of these and say, if this person came into my office, if I received this Siamese infant, you know, this conjoined infant, you know, fused at the face, what would I have told that mother? How would I have helped this person?
Mm-hmm.
So it was both to teach students unusual things that maybe they'd only come across a few times in their career, but they should learn how to deal with it, and also to challenge himself. And he got hundreds and hundreds of specimens, all of which became the foundation of what we now know to be the Mutter Museum.
He was a serious doctor, but he also was a flamboyant guy. He was a showman.
Yeah, they called him the P.T. Barnum of the operating room.
And he liked to dress, as you say, silk cravats, stylish suits, smoked cigars, right?
Yeah, he was well known for matching his suit to his horse to his carriage when he rode around Philadelphia. I mean, he loved the attention and believed he deserved the attention and believed that he used the attention for good, to shine a spotlight on the work that he was doing, which was extremely innovative and very very much clash with the sentiments of his time period. You know, we talked about other doctors, you know, Charles D. Miggs, who was the chair of obstetrics at the same time that Mutter was the chair of surgery. You know, Mutter was spending all of this time working with patients, treating them as equals, doing preoperative care, postoperative care. And Miggs, on the other hand, was lecturing from his professorial perch that women, who were his only patients, that women as heads were too small for intellect, but just the right size for love. Just to breed that contempt, he would say, teach his students, we are women's masters and lords, and you need to put them in their place. So those are from the same school, being taught to the same groups of students. So the ideological ideas were clashing constantly. And Mutter, unfortunately, did not live long enough to see many of his ideas proven true, but that makes his journey even more miraculous, that he used scientific process and not a microscope to understand that not washing your hands and tools would produce an infection, or, you know, without having cancer cells identified, knowing that removing a breast tumors of a woman isn't going to prevent her from dying from cancer. The cancer will have spread by that point. All of those things he pieced together without any science to back him up, which makes, you know, his story even more amazing, and why I'm so proud to be sharing it with Dr. Mutter's Marvels.
Kristen, I want to talk a little bit more about the era of Dr. Mutter, because I guess people get a sense of what surgery was like from your description of it earlier. But other things that were going on during that time, and I was struck by, things that we learned from your book, Fossey Jaw, P-H-O-S-S-Y.
Yes.
As in phosphorus, I guess?
Yes.
Fossey Jaw. What was Fossey Jaw?
So when researching, anytime I read nonfiction, I'm a huge reader of nonfiction, I always ask myself, if I was alive during this time period, who would I be in this story? And frequently, I'm sort of ignored. Working class girls, not really a demographic that people tend to write about.
Which Jane Austen character would you
exactly.
be? I'm sorry.
So I looked into that for this book and saw, okay, what were the working class girls having to do in that time period? And one of the popular vocations that they would have were matchstick girls. They were essentially put into a dark factory, no electric lighting, given these slivers of wood, and they had to dip them into phosphorus until it creates a match tip. And they would constantly be licking their fingers, right, to manage all of these small bits of wood in the dark. But they didn't realize at the time that phosphorus was, you know, a toxic chemical, radioactive. And so it would begin as sort of like swollen gums and a sore tooth would eventually open a hole in the side of their cheek, and the wound would grow so large that you could see all the way to the bone. And as if this disfigurement wasn't horrible enough, because of the chemicals they were ingesting, the jaw bones and teeth would glow greenish white in the dark. And this is astounding by contemporary standards, but again, was so common back then that it had a nickname, Fossey Jaw.
So a woman or a girl with Fossey Jaw might go see Dr. Mutter for help with that opening and that
absolutely
decay.
To be able to help you know, heal the wound. But by that time, you know, the chemicals will have gotten to her brain, and she would get, you know, brain failure and heart
so that's
failure.
More of a commentary on the times we're discussing here.
You know,
because some of the people who went to see Dr. Mutter had been injured in accidents in factories, right?
Absolutely. You know, people come to the Mutter Museum a lot and say, you know, how come we don't see some of this stuff anymore? And the answer is, you know, we have early intervention. You know, some of these disfigurements can be identified as a child and won't progress any further. We've made, you know, sanitation of our water and streets to stop the spread of these sorts of diseases. Nutrition, you know, we know to prenatal vitamins are going to help prevent a lot of birth defects, but also labor loss. You know,
laws,
a lot of these things.
Children and women. Yeah.
Right. Were just, you know, factories run wild, and they didn't take care of the people within them. And labor laws have really prevented the industrial accidents that caused horrific deformities back then that surgeons like Mutter were asked to fix. And truly only, you know, Mutter was the one who fixed them. The rest of them, they would, you know, wouldn't perform surgeries on people unless it was life or death.
Women also had highly flammable clothing back then.
Yes.
You note that in the book.
Right.
Which
this
caused
was
fires, which caused damage, which could kill or injure or kill people, right?
Yeah, it was a very common disfigurement to have severely burned women. Women burned in the face and neck because they wore these very constrictive clothing, inflammable, you know, fabrics, and worked in front of open flames. And it didn't take a lot, like a child running over and grabbing her leg or an ember just tumbling out, for the dress to catch fire. And because it was so tightly bound to the woman, it would almost create like a chimney effect. So the flames would run straight up her bodice and she wouldn't be able to get out quickly enough. Now, women were completely dependent on men during this time period. They couldn't own their own property. They couldn't make a living that could support themselves. So frequently, instead of seeking treatment for these burned women, they were hidden away so that it wouldn't bring shame on the family. And the family would just hope the woman would heal by herself. And I found letter after letter after letter of these burned women writing to Mutter saying, "You please treat me. I would rather die on your surgical table than spend one more day looking like I do."
Now, he became known for the skin flap, right?
Yeah.
Can you explain that to our listeners, how that developed?
Sure. So back then, they didn't have any cure for any sort of burns. You know, they tried early grafting where they would remove chunks of skin from a thigh and put it on a face. And it just, you know, I mean, they weren't very sanitary. So infection was going to happen anyway. But the blood never connected with the skin. But Mutter realized in his work that if you remove a portion of the skin but still keep it attached to the body, that blood would flow from that flap that attaches it to the body into the part and help with the reattachment and the rest. So he created something known as the Mutter flap surgery, which today's surgeons still use. You know, when I talk about the Mutter, Thomas Dent Mutter, people know the name from the museum. Unless I'm talking to surgeons, then they know the name from the flap. And
That skin comes from another part of the body, right?
So he would cut out the part of the face and neck that was heavily scarred, and then take pretty much the exact same shape off the skin of her back or shoulder, which was not affected by the burns because the burns ran up the front because of the tightly constricted bodice, and then manipulated it over while still keeping it attached at the neck. And again, the patient was awake the entire time during these surgeries. So people talk about the bravery of Mutter, but these women who subjected themselves for long surgeries, and they had to be sober because alcohol, if you've ever drank, you know, alcohol can make you bleed really easy. It sort of thins out the blood. So they were cold stone sober, and they had to sit upright in a chair because they were taking skin from the front, skin from the back. It's amazing that they survived at all. And
so,
they did.
So the women are taking a risk, obviously, right?
Yes.
But they're going through this surgery, trusting this doctor,
right?
With the hopes that they're going to look better when it's over with, right?
Right, that they'll be able to rejoin society and not be known as monsters, which they literally were. And you know, the book has over 80 illustrations, and all of the engravings that you see of these severely deformed people are all actual patients of Mutter. So all of the burned women that you see in Dr. Mutter's marvels are his actual patients whose faces he was able to transform.
But he didn't treat only those people. He treated others who needed surgery for other reasons, right?
Absolutely. I mean, he was a general surgeon, mm-hmm. worked in the surgical theater, but he made a specialty of those, and people came from all over. And it's interesting you mentioned that, you know, one of the innovations that he came up with that wasn't surgical, but certainly we appreciate as modern people, was the recovery room. You know, prior to Mutter, if you went to a surgical clinic, after your surgery, they would just stick you in the back of a wagon and send you home over the cobblestone streets
of
Philadelphia.
Pretty much happens today, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You don't spend a lot of time in a hospital these days, right? Put them in a wagon, send them home. They give you a wheelchair ride to the front door, and you're gone.
Yeah, hook them out. Yeah, no. But he thought this was crazy, and he insisted that Jefferson Medical College, today's Jefferson University, build these, and they refused. They didn't understand.
Oh, they didn't understand the need for a recovery room?
No, they didn't understand. This is the way it had always been done. And so he actually spent his own money to rent out rooms above a restaurant and then transported his patients up there, and he and his students
He's a very humane, empathetic guy, right?
Absolutely.
But this is an interesting personality study, though, Mutter. This is going to be a movie, a made-for-TV movie, or better than that, isn't it?
From your lips to God's ears,
don't
as my grandma
Aren't you selling
would say.
The cinematic rights to this?
Yes.
Because what a character. So he goes to Paris. We skipped over Paris. We don't want to skip over Paris.
Yes.
Because at the time, it was considered a medical mecca, right?
Absolutely.
It's where you went to learn how to be a surgeon.
Yeah, they gave free health care to all of its 1 million citizens. And because of that, they had these very specialized hospitals. So if you were a laboring woman, you went to one hospital. If you were an elderly couple that wanted to die together, you went to another hospital. They had two hospitals devoted just to the treatment of syphilis. One for women, and let me tell you, no one survived the women's hospital for syphilis, and one for men. And in order to be admitted as a patient for the syphilis hospital for men, you had to be whipped publicly as punishment for contracting syphilis. And then if you survived the month-long treatment, you'd be whipped again upon exiting to make sure you learned your lesson.
I'm so glad you told that story, because I saw that in the notes and I said, Really?
Yeah.
We're going to beat you.
Right.
And that's your entree to treatment.
Yes.
And then if you get through the treatment,
yep.
on your way out of the hospital, just for good measure, we're going to beat you again to what? Humiliate you? Is that it?
Make sure you learned your lesson. It's very French.
That's very... Liberté, égalité, and we're going to whip you for getting syphilis.
Yes.
Don't let it happen again. Stay away from the prostitutes. Next. All right. Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz is with us. APTOWICZ. Dr. Mutter's Marvels. Mutter's Marvels. A true tale of intrigue and innovation at the dawn of modern medicine. Is it in Paris where he develops all that style of his, all this foppish haberdashery?
He had it beforehand, but it didn't help. I mean, he really took it to the limit when he came back from Paris. I think he was exposed to different styles and silk clothing. And you have to imagine Quaker Philadelphia was not used to pink suits swanning down their streets.
No.
But he that was his way, you know. And I think he believed that he used it for good. You know, I think he believed the more attention he attracted in himself, the more focus will be put on his work, which was true and false.
But he needed people to take him seriously.
Yeah,
though,
he alienated just as many people as he attracted. But his skill was like no one else's. So he picked the greatest field to go into if you were going to have skill trump everything else, and that was surgery.
Another appeal of Dr. Mutter was his teaching style, right? He had a lot of students, and he had great classes, apparently. He was very popular.
Yeah. Medical schools in the early 19th century were essentially lecture halls. You know, you would get a ticket and go to these lectures. They would go on the pulpit, and they would speak, sometimes without any illustration at all, and then leave. They wouldn't answer any questions. And that was just how medical school was done. Mutter brought in what was known as the style of quizzing, that he would ask questions to his student to make sure that they knew what they were learning. In addition to that, Jefferson Medical College was the first college ever to do surgical and medical clinics, watching your professor actually interact with patients and showing them working with patients or doing surgeries on patients. Prior to that, you would just hear a doctor talking about it. And both of those things were revolutionary. His students adored him. They loved that how he treated his patients, and they loved how he treated his students, not as people who would be disgusting if you don't understand if I say it right the first time, but someone who was interested in making sure they embraced and understood both his surgical techniques and his philosophies towards medicine. You know, he really taught them to be empathetic doctors at a time when that was not the de rigueur.
Right. No, this is what's interesting to me is how they went about convincing people that what they were doing was going to be better than what medicine had been up till then, right? If you grew up with leeches purgatives or poultice or special home brews of things, right, to remedy this and remedy that. How are they going to convince people? I guess, as you said earlier, it took a long time.
Right. And
people had to start living longer.
A great example of this is ether anesthesia. You know, you have ether anesthesia, which was discovered in 1846, and you would think that surgeons would go, whoa, 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 hold on a second. I can perform a surgery on a perfectly still, pain-free, unconscious person, and then at the end will them back to life. This is a miracle drug. Get me as much of it as you can. No. It was not that case at all.
They didn't want it?
There was a lot of sentiment against it, and it was actually banned in hospitals for years and years and years. People wrote about it being a satanic influence, robbing men of their reason. And there's any number of factors that contributed to that that makes sense. You know, one of them is that, again, we were talking about surgeons. Their entire careers, they're spent working on patients who were awake. That's how they knew to do it. A great example of this would be if you're working on a patient and you're talking to them and they begin to sort of lose focus and it looks like they're going to lose consciousness, you know, at that point, oh, this person might be at risk of bleeding out. I better stop the surgery and sew them up or they're going to die on my table. If the patient is already unconscious, how do you know that's happening? They didn't have the medical tools we have today to do pulse rate and blood pressure, even a syringe to infuse new blood.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I'd never considered before was the standardization of medicine. You didn't have pharmaceutical companies that we have right now where a Tylenol in Chicago is going to be the same Tylenol in Baltimore, right? No, you had different people mixing together jars of ether that were going to be of varying strengths depending on who made it, when it was made, what was available to make it with it. So these doctors were using what they saw as a very unstable chemical. Used too little, the patient could wake up. Used too much, they could die. It seems ludicrous to use such a chemical you couldn't control. And the last thing, of course, was that germ theory wouldn't be proven until the late 19th century. So it turned out that surgery performed on someone who was etherized and unconscious for the surgery, and surgeries performed on someone who was thrashing on the table, the death rates were pretty much exactly the same. Because it wasn't the surgeries themselves.
It was the infection.
It was the infections afterwards. So until all of those pieces came together, ether anesthesia wasn't truly embraced by the medical community, which in my research was like one of the most fascinating elements. And you realize how much that happens in different ways throughout scientific progress altogether. You know, I'm an artist, so I knew artists was messy, but I didn't realize how much science could be messy and chaotic as well.
Did Dr. Mutter use ether?
Yes. As soon as he read about it, he knew this was the future of surgery. And he was the first doctor in Philadelphia to perform an ether surgery 1 month after it was introduced in Boston.
Wow. He got someone to do that.
Yeah.
So he did have some brave patients who were willing to take risks with him.
Yeah, they trusted him.
And they came to trust him. Yeah. And by the way, we're going to take a break here. When we get back, we'll talk about laughing gas parties. Were there laughing gas parties in the 19th century?
Absolutely.
We'll take a break here and come back and talk some more. If you have a question for our guests, this is a good time to call us on midday, 410-662-8780. Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz, our guest in this hour. Her book is Dr. Mutter's Marvels, a true tale of intrigue and innovation at the dawn of modern medicine. Gotham Books, an imprint of
Penguin.
Penguin is the publisher. And I'll also tell you where you can meet Kristen tonight. She's in Baltimore for a book talk this evening. I'll tell you about that when we get back. 410-662-8780 is our local phone number, toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. Welcome back. It's midday. Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz, her book on Dr. Mutter, Dr. Mutter's Marvels. By the way, the title of your book, Dr. Mutter's Marvels, that was never the title of a show in Philadelphia, was it?
No. Why do you ask?
Because he donated his collection of specimens. He did not live to see the museum.
Yes.
Right. Even though he became known as the P.T. Barnum of the operating room. He didn't really market his collection in any way, right?
No, not at all.
He didn't want people. This was for students, mainly.
It was for students, though he did say in his will that he also wanted it open to artists. He wanted artists to be able to come in and do sketches and paintings of the specimens he collected as well to explore the different types of human bodies.
So when you see skulls, for instance, or whole skeletons at the Mutter Museum, where did he get those? Did he perform autopsies? Were those former patients of his, or were they come from cadavers?
It's pretty charming. I found so many letters of his where he'd be like, "Oh, good to hear about your daughter playing piano. Da 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 da. P.S. If you have an unusual tumors, you can send me." So he made friends with students and colleagues, and at the end of every letter, he would say, "If you come across anything unusual in your special field, I would love to have it as a teaching tool." And even after he retired, he would have students sending him stuff, and people were so devoted to Mutter, his students, that they would send things to the museum from the Civil War battlefield. And many times the director of the museum at that time period would have to go to the postmaster's office in Philadelphia, and they would find this like leaking box of blood coming out of it and going, "Would you like to explain what this is?"
Oh,
and he'd
wow.
go, "We're a medical museum, wow. so please give us whatever that is. And we'll immediately put it in a jar."
He was taken seriously, right? By the time Hopkins is established, Hopkins Hospital, Hopkins University, doctors are drawing from Mutter's studies, his journals, right?
He was not taken as seriously as he had hoped. And one of the things he focused on was working in surgery, and he did not spend the time in publication that other doctors had. Dr. Miggs, who we talked about, the chair of obstetrics, he published textbook after textbook after textbook, espousing his philosophies. Mutter did not do that until he was much later in his career. And in fact, the textbook that he created in 1846 was, it focused a lot on preoperative care as well as postoperative care. And he thought, "Oh, this is going to be, you know, the groundbreaking book that is going to introduce me." And months later, Ether Anesthesia was discovered, and he realized this is an obsolete book already. This book I spent months working on, years of my life working on, no longer exists because we have this miracle drug that we won't need any of this stuff anymore. So after that, he stopped publishing. He realized, I'm just going to stay on the cutting edge of what's happening technology-wise, teach my students, and let them do it, a decision I think he later grew to regret.
And Dr. Miggs, on the other side, we're pronouncing it Miggs, but it's M-E-I-G-S, right?
Yes, I think that they pronounced it Meggs back Meggs. There, but Miggs sounds so more
it
dastardly.
Does. He was a rival of Mutter, it sounds like, and he resisted using anesthesia. He's one of those doctors who didn't believe in it, right?
Right, absolutely. So while Mutter was doing ether anesthesias for, you know, his generations of students, showing them how to do it safely and cleanly, Miggs, teaching the exact same class of students, would bring sheep into his lecture hall.
Sheep.
And gas them to death to prove how dangerous it was. There's a really wonderful scene in the book where we cut one of the, where we bring out one of the lectures that he gave when he was talking about the dangers of ether anesthesia. And if this was, you know, a mother who came to you and she asked for pain during labor and you did this to her, how could you live with yourself? He was a very theatrical professor, and he would have tears in his eyes and, you know, lean against the railings as if overcome with emotion. So he was doing this whole spiel he usually does. And from behind him, he heard, bah. It turned out he hadn't used enough ether.
The sheep
came back to life after he gave this terrible lecture about the dangers and this dead woman. Well, she's all right now. And the entire class erupted into laughter. And it was a very cathartic moment. When I read that in the archive, I nearly fell out of my chair.
You found great stuff in this archive. Speaking of laughter, I asked you before the break if there were laughing gas parties in the 19th century. Indeed, there were.
Absolutely. You know, when the powers of ether anesthesia were first discovered, they were discovered actually by a British chemist, and he said, oh my God, if I breathe in this gas, it makes me, I don't feel any pain at all. I know exactly what I can use this for, a hangover cure. And indeed, that's how he pitched it. And all of his experiments for like a year were, how many bottles of wine can I drink in one night and the next morning take this gas and be okay? So literally that was the future.
God.
When it hit America, they would have ether frolics and laughing gas parties where audiences would come in and they would bring someone on stage and gas them up and make them do silly things. And it was actually a dentist who was going to one of these things, saw a man do a silly dance, fall off the stage and clearly break his leg, but kind of get up and seem to feel no pain. And he thought, wait a minute. It's one thing to sort of not know where you are. It's a whole other thing not to feel pain when you've clearly broken something. I bet I could use this in my dentistry. And that was the path that started moving it as a medical use. So it was a recreational use that moved that into the medical use.
Did you ever have it?
No.
I actually went to a dentist who used something like that. I don't know if it was nitrous. Is it nitrous oxide?
They had nitrous oxide. They also used formaldehyde and ether anesthesia as well.
This is like 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful. Really, it was the best dental appointment I ever had. I fell in love with the dental hygienist. We got married later that day. And then we saw pink dinosaurs. It was wonderful. It was really, I don't know whatever happened to that.
Yeah, so you would have been the circus barker going, we don't need to do a medical use. Right. Let's just have fun with this.
Did Dr. Thomas Dent Mutter ever marry?
He did marry. He married a woman named Mary Alsop. She was from a very well-connected family.
Alsop, like A-L-S-O-P, Alsop?
Yep.
That was a pretty famous name back then.
Yeah, you know, the Connecticut Alsops, they helped found Wesleyan, and they were very well connected, but they never had any children. And some people ask a lot about his death. You know, he died very young at the age of 46. And
excuse me, you say very young. In the 19th century, is 46 considered very young still?
Yeah, for what his position was, for a doctor of a certain amount of wealth who was taking good care of himself, you know, that was pretty shocking. I mean, he was the youngest faculty member. He was hired at the age of 31, and he was also the first to die. So you had people who were two decades older who were still practicing medicine and still a professor while he was, you know, dead in the ground.
But he had no children.
And he had no children. So some people think that because of that, that maybe people think that he maybe died of consumption, said at the time hereditary gout, but people, there's a theory that he had a congenital syphilis, speaking of syphilis again, and that's what killed his entire family and rendered him sterile, even though he survived.
Killed his entire family?
Yeah, that, you know, things like that would happen. They have no idea, you know, what diseases were or how to cure them, how diseases spread. So, you know, his father could have gotten syphilis and then passed it to his, you know, wife, who then gave birth to a child, you know, children with syphilis, and it wouldn't blister up until far later.
And speaking of far later, do you think Mutter was appreciated far later than he was in his time?
It's really interesting. You know, people always ask me, how come we haven't heard of Thomas Dent Mutter before? Because he played such an important role in American medicine. And I think a part of the reason for that is that in the last few years of his life, he dissolved his own legacy. So we talked about how important looking flamboyant was and being seen as this singular genius. When he realized that he was dying, and he went to Paris for treatment, and they said, there is no treatment for what you have. You've only got a matter of time left. They actually begged him to stay in Paris where the treatment would be better. But he realized that he had branded himself as the one person who could be the savior of all of these people, and that when he died, who would take care of these people. So he went back to America and spent the last years of his life making sure his students, his peers, and his colleagues knew that they could do the surgeries that he was doing. Maybe not as quickly, maybe not inventing new ones, but he could treat the people that he was already treating. And in doing so, he made, you know, he took himself out of the running of being the person who was decades above everyone else. Additionally, he never had children, so you had no family. You know, his entire immediate family was dead, and he had no children, so there was no one there to champion his legacy after he died. Really, he only had the museum. And so I think that, you know, I think that that his legacy really died with him,
right,
and slowly
even
dissolved
before he
away.
Died. Even
yeah.
before he died, I guess.
And so that's why
it's interesting
so
that he trained students. He felt that was important to train the next generation.
Absolutely. You know, he realized when he came to Philadelphia and with this idea of plastic surgery, oh, my, I have this new field that I learned in Europe. You talk to me. I'm the one in the pink suit. And, you know, the old guard doctors were not interested. You know,
right.
they had their set ways, and they didn't want anyone disagreeing with them. And he realized, if I'm going to make a movement in the field of medicine, the field of surgery, it's going to have to be young, fresh minds who are still impressionable.
Kristen, I wish you would talk a little bit about the collection again, the extent of it, the scope of it, and how it ended up as a museum in Philadelphia.
So the Mutter Museum, when he died, he wanted to make sure this collection that he created wouldn't be broken up and given to sideshows. Back then, you'd have bars where you'd pay a dollar and see a jar of something gross. He didn't want any of that to happen with this collection that he had hand-pieced together. So he tried to find a home with it, and a lot of people, it was just too big and too weird. They didn't want to do it, but he found a home with the college.
We'll take everything but the colon, okay?
Yeah. The College of Physicians of Philadelphia, and demanded that they build a fireproof museum in 4 years. Unfortunately, it was the same 4 years as the Civil War, but they did it. They did
they
it.
They did which one? The College of Philadelphia?
The College of Physicians of Philadelphia, which it was the old school version of college. It wasn't actual.
That's not, he wasn't associated with that college, was he?
No, it wasn't a real college. It was meant like a society.
Oh, okay.
Like a, you know, a collegiate, you know.
But he was turned down at the first place.
He was turned down at Jefferson, his own home institution. It was too big and too
but
weird.
But the society agreed to build such a place.
Yeah, a fireproof museum to house this enormous collection. And then they began attracting other doctors. And what's really interesting about the Mutter Museum is that it's a collection of people, doctors, who were passionate about one thing. You know, when you think of doctors, you think anything that comes into your room, you know, you're going to have to deal with. But there were some doctors who just became fascinating with proving something or disproving something. So the Hurdle Skull Collection, which is sort of a famous part of the Mutter Museum, it's a collection of, you know, over 100 skulls collected from all across the world. And the deaths of the people are written on their heads in the bone in ink. So it says, you know, an Italian tightrope walker died of a broken neck. You know, who would have guessed? And he was obsessed with disproving phrenology. You know, the idea that you could use a skull and determine if people were good or evil or dumb or bright. And he was successful in it. But he'd spent years of his life traveling around the world collecting these corpses. And you have examples of that all throughout the museum. Passionate doctors, as passionate as Mutter, laser focused on their one obsession. Mm. And the Mutter Museum gets to be its final home.
Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz is the author of Dr. Mutter's Marvels, A True Tale of Intrigue and Innovation at the Dawn of Modern Medicine. Gotham Books is the publisher. Kristen Aptowitz will be appearing tonight, 7 p.m., at the Johns Hopkins Barnes & Noble. That's up in Charles Village at 33rd Street in St. Paul. She'll give a book talk at 7 o'clock, and there'll be a slideshow of images, too.
So maybe don't eat beforehand.
Yeah, okay. Kristen, it's been great having you on the show.
Thank you so much. It's
thank
been
you
a real
very
pleasure.
Much. Yeah, congratulations on this. You've been working on this a long time. There was the film and the fellowship and all that, and you finally get the book done.
Yes.
So congratulations.
Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's our midday for today. Again, if you want to go meet Kristen tonight, get a copy of her book, or just hear her talk and see the slideshow, it's at the Johns Hopkins Barnes & Noble at 33rd Street in St. Paul. Have a great afternoon. We'll see you again soon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Beatrix Lockwood, Adam Dronberg, and Aaron Morenzi. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.